Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, musical notes to meditate on the mysteries of the Rosary. An exclusive interview with the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, His Beatitude Fouad Toile. And sharing a conversation with the author of Faith Maps, 10 religious explorers, among whom Newman and Benedict XVI. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Wednesday this week, on the eve of the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, which falls each year on the 7th of October, Benedict XVI pronounced the following words in Italian. October is the month of the Holy Rosary.
Ottobre è il mese del Santo Rosario.
During which we're invited to enhance this prayer, so dear to our Christian tradition.
Che ci invita a valorizzare questa preghiera.
Having listened to the Holy Father's words, I thought I'd share with you a musical program focusing on the first joyful mystery of the Rosary, the Annunciation. As we pray the Rosary, we're invited to meditate on the particular scene that this mystery evokes, and to enter deeply into it as we recite the Our Father, the Hail Marys, and the Gloria Patri. As music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore told me, sometimes art can help us to focus our minds prayerfully on the mystery. Other times, music can help.
Those words, Ave Maria, Gratia Plena, take us straight to the heart of the first joyful mystery, the Annunciation. I'm sure we all have our favourite paintings of the angel appearing to Mary. Maybe the one by Leonardo da Vinci, or that breathtaking fresco by Fra Angelico in the Convento di San Marco in Florence. But there are plenty of musical images too. For one thing, of course, there are lots of settings of the Ave Maria, bringing us the angel's greeting in song.
Ave Maria, gratia plena.
Then again, you'll often find composers telling the story of the Annunciation, as in this famous medieval English carol, Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
The setting I've chosen to concentrate on today is different again. It's a modern piece by the living English composer John Taverner, a member of the Orthodox Church. He wrote this piece in 1992, and it's for two unaccompanied choirs. The larger choir represents the angel, and the smaller choir represents Mary, overawed and trembling, repeating at regular intervals the same phrase, "How shall this be, seeing I know not a man?" The piece works best if the two choirs are in different locations, so that you get the dramatic effect of the dialogue between Mary and the angel. The first time I heard it was in Westminster Cathedral in 1995, when John Taverner himself gave a lecture about sacred music, and it was illustrated by some of his own works sung by the cathedral choir. When they sang his Annunciation, the small choir representing Mary was in the Lady Chapel, while the large choir sang from the sanctuary. The effect was stunning.
Ave
The music has a prayerful quality that's hard to describe, but you can tell it's the fruit of profound meditation on the part of the composer. It draws the listener into a deeper contemplation of the mystery too. I'd like to leave you with what, for me, is the most sublime passage of all, as we hear the angels sing, "Blessed art thou among women, blessed indeed."
Well, our thanks there go to music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. I'd like to move on in the broadcast. Here in the Vatican, in fact, finishing touches are being put to the organisation of a synod of bishops dedicated to the Middle East. A synod which will run from Sunday 10th of October through to the 24th, and will have as theme the Catholic Church in the Middle East, Communion and Witness. As it's about to take centre stage, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, His Beatitude Fouad Toile, tells Tracy McClure how it all came about and also reflects on some of the key issues he's called to deal with.
My first question would be, why do you think that Pope Benedict called this synod at this particular time?
Well, I think, first of all, we, Patriarchs of the Middle East Catholic, we asked the Pope to meet with him. Not all are cardinals, not all have this occasion. But I think that the idea of the synod came out just after the visit of His Holiness to the Holy Land. He could touch and suffer from our divisions here in the Holy Land, with so many confessions and faiths and churches, whether Catholic, Orthodox, Armenian, Anglican, and so on. In the same time, he had a not bad but painful experience about the conflict between Arabs and the Israeli people. And I think, knowing well the situation in the Middle East, he thought to launch this synod in October. On the last September, 19 September last year, we had a convocation to be with him in Castel Gandolfo, and we shared dinner with him. And then came out the idea of the synod little by little. And little by little, we took the titles and the themes of the lineamenti that you know. I think the idea of the synod came...
The churches in the Middle East share common riches and problems as well. While they find themselves a minority in a predominantly Muslim society, you here in the Holy Land find yourselves in a more complex situation, in a region in conflict, a tiny community wedged between Jews and Muslims. What do you see as the challenges your Christian community faces that perhaps sets you in some way apart from the other churches in the Middle East?
More or less, we have the same common problems, whether in Iraq and Lebanon, but maybe here with a little bit more intensity in the Holy Land. That's why I say I think that Jerusalem is the key for more peace or the key for more problems, more conflict that we are living here. For the Christians, I think the first challenge is ourselves to be true Christians, is our identity as Christians. Before looking about the problems coming from outside, from Jews and Muslims, I think it would be nice if we can meditate how we respect and how we love our identity as Christians. Christians of the Holy Land, it is a special vocation. It is not only a presence like any other presence. I just met now an Italian group, and I told them that we have to take seriously the words of the Lord, at least from time to time when we suffer, and to remember that He said us, if anybody wants to follow me, he must bear his cross and follow me. That's why we have to take seriously these words. Cross a cross before us in this narrow streets of Jerusalem. He fooled, he suffered, and so on. And we have to suffer to accept this mission, this vocation to be here with our cross. In the same time, I said often, we are not only a church of Calvary, we are in the same time a church of resurrection, of hope, and we must have hope and give this hope for people who are suffering from the situation. And when they cannot stand, when they cannot resist to this dramatic situation, the first option that they have is to leave. And this is our hemorrhage for this emigration of our Christians.
You say that Christians here should be bearing the cross, but at the same time, I've also heard many of the Christian churches here in the Middle East speak of, you know, Christians should be more involved in politics, should be more involved in taking a stand on the social issues, some of the issues that concern them as citizens of each of these states.
You are right. I think this role to be more involved in the society, I think we had it more in Jordan than here. In Jordan, in fact, we have ministers and deputies and banks, and they are more involved in the society, maybe because there is more stability, political stability there. Here, with the occupation, with our number, always less and less and less. First of all, Israel will never give them this chance to have a big role in politics. And besides, the Palestinians are divided between themselves, between Fatah, Hamas, and so on and so on. You are absolutely right that the Christians in the Holy Land are not playing a good, strong role in politics. We, church, we through our institutions, we try to give them more awareness, more trust, more confidence, more. We can, but the fact that with the immigration, we lost a lot of our best elements, those with culture and those young people with diploma and so on and so on. And the rest is the rest. Yeah, we are helping them through the institutions to have this role, but you are absolutely right that they haven't this right now.
You were listening there to the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, his Beatitude Fouad Toal, speaking to Tracy McClure. And finally, you may remember how Pope Benedict, on the occasion of the beatification of John Henry Newman, announced that the Church would celebrate his feast day on the 9th of October. Let's listen to the Pope's words in Birmingham on that occasion.
This feast shall be celebrated every year on the 9th of October in the places and according to the norms established by church law.
The reason I mention this is that in a few moments I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had this week with a Jesuit who teaches fundamental theology at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. He's Father Michael Paul Gallagher, author of Faith Maps, 10 Religious Explorers. Published by Darton Longman and Todd, the book has a warm orangey-yellow cover, clearly with the names of the 10 explorers, but also the images of the first and last of these. You may have guessed, they're John Henry Newman and Pope Benedict. Well, in an effort to find out more about this book, in a special way about the two theologians featured on the cover, I sat down to enjoy a conversation with a man who claims in the introduction of the book that what began with Enid Blyton ended up with Hans Urs von Balthasar. So in your intention, who are the explorers then following a treasure trove of faith, the characters you focus on in this book? I believe there's even an American.
Well, this one great lady, a great comic, wise lady called Flannery O'Connor, who will be perhaps known to many of the listeners as probably the greatest Catholic writer of the century, some people would argue. The others are more predictable. They're some of the famous theologians like Rahner or Lonergan or Balthasar. And then there are a few people a little bit outside the usual line of the great giants of the century, like Charles Taylor, who is now a very distinguished philosopher who brought out an enormous book called A Secular Age just a few years ago, which has had a huge success. And then, at least in the English-speaking world, the surprising name is Pierangelo Siqueri. But in Italy, it wouldn't be a surprise, he is one of the best-known theologians from the Milan school.
Let me guess, all of them 20th century, except John Henry Newman, who was of the 19th century, and Maurice Blondel, who bridged the two centuries.
I started off with Newman and then ended up, of course, with the present Pope as theologian Joseph Ratzinger. In each chapter, I try to give the first part to a summary of what they would say about the adventure, about a faith map with quotations and so on. But then in the second half, at least in most of the cases, I try to do an imaginary monologue. What would they say to us today? I put words in their mouths that I hope are faithful to their vision to communicate perhaps a more spiritual, more imaginative vision of the road to faith.
So your background must be literature then. Am I guessing right?
You're guessing perfectly. In fact, it's more than my background. I spent more than 20 years teaching literature in University College Dublin. I'm more qualified in literature than in theology. I came to theology later in life.
This doesn't seem like bedside reading. You compress the monumental works of Newman in 10 pages before you have your monologue. Newman, whose prolific pen Pope Benedict highlighted in his homily during the beatification ceremony in Birmingham on the 19th of September. How do you compress Newman into 10 pages?
Can't compress everything of Newman. He wrote 60 volumes in all, including the 33 volumes of his letters. Of course, I'm not compressing the whole of Newman, but I am trying to do justice to what I think are the key elements in his way of approaching faith. For instance, from the point of view of a person's disposition. He had an argument with his brother when young John Henry was only about 20 or 21 and his younger brother, called Charles, announced himself to be an atheist. And we have the letters that went between them and records of their conversations. And he tried to argue his brother into believing in God. And then he realized the futility of that approach. He said to his brother, it's your disposition is all wrong. Now, that was a simple insight, but it really gave him the foundation for all his approach to faith later on. It's easy to summarize some of the elements in Newman's approach to faith, apart from the stress on what he calls the preparation of heart. Without a preparation of heart, your reason won't be working fully. Another one would be that, quite simply, faith is very ordinary. We can make it into a verb. We faith all the time. When we turn on our microphone, we trust that it's working, even though we haven't tested it. The act of trusting is fundamental for daily life. And Newman, even in his great book, The Grammar of Assent, talks about, well, you know, has anyone really walked around Great Britain and proved that it's an island? We take so much on trust from other people. And he would say that faith is like that. The content is totally different, the content of God's love for us and Christ's saving of us. But the actual act of faith is terribly ordinary, he insisted.
I have to take back my words that this is no bedside reading. You make it sound very approachable.
Thank you. I think it's slow reading rather than fast reading. My intention was to give people good meat, but in small quantities.
From Newman to Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, and we can talk about him before he became Pope and after he became Pope.
In his chapter, as in one other chapter, I don't do an imaginative monologue. Instead, the first part is what he said in his years as a theologian right up to becoming Pope in 2005, April of 2005. And then the second half of that chapter is what he has said on the theme of faith, broken down into various sub-themes since becoming Pope. And I've put the parallels between them and what's new and what's old and so on. He has, in fact, drawn on his previous thought quite substantially since becoming Pope. He even openly, sometimes, rarely enough, quotes himself as saying that years ago I said X and I'm still saying it.
The subtitle of the book is 10 Religious Explorers. Now, you think of Newman as exploring the faith quite a bit. You don't really think of Ratzinger as an explorer of the faith, do you?
Well, I do, in fact. The very opening chapter of what is certainly his bestseller, Introduction to Christianity, it starts with the story borrowed from Kierkegaard of a clown coming into a village and saying, there's a fire, there's a fire, there's a fire. And nobody takes him seriously. He's dressed up as a clown. He's from the local circus. And they think he's putting on some kind of an advertisement. But there's a real fire. And the young Joseph Ratzinger compares this feeling of frustration in the clown to the difficulty of communicating faith today, that one can appear, the today of that, of then, was 1967, 68, in fact. But the feeling of just not able to be heard, he starts very existentially and dramatically. Indeed, he also draws on Teresa of Lisieux, on her very strange, call it dark night of the soul, if you will, the last 18 months of her life, where she pretty well went into complete darkness and said, I don't have faith anymore, I only have love. And yet she accepted this emptiness to sit at the table with unbelievers. Now, the young Joseph Ratzinger also used, if you like, the story of Thérèse to enter. So he is an explorer of faith. He has some very deep, even demanding philosophical approaches to it, but he starts from...
You go from John Henry Newman to Benedict XVI. Who do you think is most similar to John Henry Newman amongst the characters in the book?
I would say the second one, Blondel. I think Newman also is close in his own way to Lonergan, who's the least known of the great theologians of the last century, a Canadian who taught here at the Gregorian for some of his life. He read The Grammar of Assent of Newman 6 times at the age of 24, and it transformed his life. Now, he takes Newman into all sorts of other horizons, but his intellectual fire comes from his encounter with Newman.
What about Benedict XVI, then? Who do you think he's closest to? I put the question the other way around.
Of those in my book, perhaps Newman. He said, even in his homily in Birmingham, as you know, Newman has long been an important influence in my own life and thought, as he has been for so many people beyond these islands. It's a strange but happy coincidence that among the professors that the young Joseph Ratzinger had in his seminary in the years immediately after the war were 3 Newman experts. As it happened, a very strong influence of Newman experts happened to Joseph Ratzinger even before his ordination, and they left a considerable mark on him.
Can you explain that, Mark?
The mark would be to look at the crisis of faith around us, to try and find a new language of responding to it, to go back to the fathers of the church, which, after all, that was Newman's speciality in terms of theology. Newman was not a moral theologian or even a philosophical theologian. He was much more someone who was soaked in the history of the early centuries and the so-called Alexandrian fathers and so on. That was what he read, and that's what he wrote about most. His first book is about that. And the same is true of the young Father Ratzinger, that he specialized in patristics. He specialized in Augustine. He's then specialized in Bonaventure. So their areas of specialization would have had a lot in common.
The Pope also talks about the fathers of the church at his weekly catechesis here in Rome all the time. So he brings his patristics to the people, no?
The great thing about the fathers of the church is that they were preachers and poets, many of them, more so than scholastic theologians. The whole generation that I'm talking about in this book, including Father Ratzinger, but also Balthasar, for instance, stuffed his ears with cotton wool during the lectures of scholastic theology in France, he was studying at the time, and read Augustine instead. Now, Pope Benedict didn't do exactly the same about the cotton wool, but he did, like all these people, turn away from that very dry Latin Thomism of a bad kind, very unfaithful, in fact, to St. Thomas Aquinas, but they were brought up on that, they reacted against it, and part of their reaction was to go back to the sources, and the sources would be in the Fathers.
Give me a good reason why a person who's not an academic should read your book.
Because I think they will find in a fairly lucid way what great Christian thinkers have been saying over the last 100 years. It takes someone like Dorothy Sulla, who wouldn't be the most known of the names in the book, she was a great Lutheran theologian, she pushes us very strongly to be countercultural as believers. She has some great metaphors. For instance, she takes the exile of the Old Testament and she says, if you don't know you're in exile, then you're even worse. You don't know about it. So she's trying to alert us to the way in which our imagination can be kidnapped by a lifestyle around us in a way that stifles our imagination, leaves us at a loss for a language for what is deepest within us. And I think anyone, even someone who would not consider themselves a churchgoer or a full believer, I think they will find rich thinking here, I hope translated well. The first title I wanted to give to the book, but the publishers didn't like it, was Translating the Giants.
Do these theologians have a common thread, or are they antagonistic in their ideas at all?
They have a common thread in that they're all trying to give sense to faith in a time where faith seems unreal for many people. But of course they fall out with one another. I mean, there was a major difference of approach between especially Karl Rahner and Hans Urs von Balthasar, and I tried to bring that out in the book. Indeed, the difference between them is important. Rahner looked at the new culture, looked at the new sensibility, and said, more or less, we have to start from below. God's grace is working in everybody slowly, and it goes, rises up towards eventually perhaps meeting the fullness of revelation in Jesus Christ. Balthasar was not satisfied with that. Balthasar wanted to begin from above. He would say, if God has spoken, isn't that the most important thing? Why all this journey from below? And so he would put great emphasis, his big volume is called Herrlichkeit in German, glory, the glory of the Lord. So he wants to start from the high vision and rethink it so that it makes sense for today. They're two people taking very opposite approaches.
One last question. I read here that at Balthasar's funeral in 1988, the then Cardinal Ratzinger preached quoting a sermon of St. Augustine as encapsulating the focus of the great Swiss theologian. Pope Benedict was familiar with a lot of these people. I mean, he knew them personally, no? Karl Rahner, Hans Urs von Balthasar, especially. And that's it.
Yes, he would have worked with Rahner at the council. In later life, they wouldn't have seen eye to eye on everything. Then Cardinal Ratzinger would have been much more close to the thought of Balthasar from on high. He would be more, a word we haven't used yet in our conversation, Joseph Ratzinger and Balthasar would be more dialectical. In other words, that means they look at the world and they take a certain distance from it. They judge it and then try to speak to it, whereas Rahner would be much more, let's listen to the language of the world itself and speak within that language, which sometimes they would accuse of being too humanistic.
And warm thanks there to Jesuit Father Michael Paul Gallagher, author of Faith Maps, 10 Religious Explorers, published by Darton, Longman and Todd. And that's all I have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrig. Laudetur Jesus Christus.